From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, a country wounded and confused, a controversial distant war sending home a daily death toll, unemployment in the headlines, and a wheezing economy. Yes, that is 2003, but if it sounds like deja vu, you may have lived the 70s, or at least know the movies of that breakout, breakdown decade. We don't know yet what this decade will bring, but the 70s brought Hollywood out of its golden towers and into the grit of a tumultuous world. Tonight, we revisit the movies of the 70s, Disaffection and Alienation. Howard Beale, Mad as Hell and Not Willing to Take It Anymore, Nurse Ratched and Annie Hall and Michael Corleone. We take a seat at that darkened theater for Travis Bickle's descent into madness in Taxi Driver.
Loneliness has followed me my whole life, everywhere. Bars and cars, sidewalks, stores, everywhere. There's no escape. I'm God's lonely man. June 8th. My life has taken another turn again. The days move along with regularity, over and over. One day indistinguishable from the next. A long, continuous chain. Then suddenly, there is a change.
These are the characters frozen in time by what was then a new breed of Hollywood storytellers. Altman, Spielberg, Coppola, Lumet, Ashby, Scorsese, Cimino. A daring pack who proved that gritty films could make money. Tonight on Point, when Hollywood got real classic films of the 1970s, joining me now in the studio is Garen Daly, On Point movie maven and artistic director for the Dedham Community Theater. Garen, welcome.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Good. And joining us from Madison, Wisconsin tonight is Janine Basinger, chair of film studies at Wesleyan University and author of A Woman's View, How Hollywood Spoke to Women, 1930 to 1960. Janine, good to have you back.
Thank you very much.
And also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, let's go to those 70s movies.
Good to be here, Tom, and hello, Janine, and Garen. Hi.
Hi, Jack.
Jack, here we are. We you know, there's a documentary this week on the IFC cable channel on 70s movies, and it made us sit back and look at this decade. We don't know where this one's going to end yet, but it's got some eerie kind of elements that we remember from an era of soggy economy and a far-off war and a kind of divided political scene nationally. But take us back to the 70s before we even hit the movies. What was Hollywood steering into here, Jack?
Well, you know, W.H. Auden spoke of the 30s as a low, dishonest decade, but it could apply to the 70s. It began in May of 1970 with President Nixon's invasion of Cambodia and with his speech where he said that the United States would be a, quote, pitiful, helpless giant if it let a little thing like a border stand in its way. Then, in mid-decade, in April 1975, the last U.S. personnel were evacuated from the roof of the embassy in U.S. Embassy in Saigon, ending 10 years of all-out war. And the decade ended with another defeat, the seizure of the U.S. embassy in Tehran in December 1979. At home, there was a war at home. The Cambodian invasion touched off as student demonstrations all over the country. At Kent State, National Guardsmen shooting at students not 60 feet away from them, killed 4, wounded 9. And, of course, right in the middle of the decade, and the beginning of the decade, Watergate.
And so there was a decade when the country got seedy, got stoned, got real, got crazy. In a way, Garen Daly, the movies of the 70s started in 1969, Easy Rider.
Yeah, Easy Rider has to be the beginning of this period. It sets out the myth of what the counterculture was all about. Peter Fonda and Dennis Hopper traveling along the roads of America, searching for freedom, trying to discover themselves, and also they lay out all those basic myths, getting back to the country, free love, drugs, finding a higher conscience. You know, and one of the things that you have to remember about this period is that the Hollywood producers were out of touch with America.
They had been going into the 70s?
Well,
they were in the 70s.
In the 60s, they really kind of lost. I mean, Hollywood was always about creating stars and manufacturing stars. All of a sudden, these things didn't work anymore, and we needed to find something else to excite ourselves going to the movies. And a new crop of directors came forward wanting to tell really true stories about real people, real issues, and really getting down to the basic core of what it was. We didn't want fantasy anymore. We wanted reality.
Janine, how did these breakout directors take advantage, or did they take advantage of the social turmoil? Did Hollywood get unsure of its old verities and open the door to these shaggy young guys who, with a new way of telling stories?
First of all, I'd like to put the business in perspective a little bit. I mean, when we reach the end of the 60s, you not only have Easy Rider, but Alice's Restaurant and The Wild Bunch, three enormously popular movies that showed producers the trends to follow. More anti-heroes, more youth-oriented new counterculture movies, and more violence and sex. And that, those are the big three there that point us toward the decade. But also, as the 1970s rolled around, fewer and fewer people were going to the movies. When something came out they wanted, they went in larger numbers than ever before, but they didn't go regularly, and fewer movies were made in Hollywood than in any other decade, and that's very significant.
Was that because, Janine, the old patterns weren't working? The country was splintering into different views?
That's right. I mean, first of all, the main factor, of course, is that the Hollywood studio system collapsed in the 1960s, and they couldn't economically grind them out because one of the reasons they couldn't, there was more foreign product to compete. Television was there. There were a lot of factors, the consent decrees against them for being monopolies. But there's a couple of figures that film historians always cite. In 1946, 78 million people went to the movies on a weekly basis. In 1971, 15 million people went to the movies on a regular basis. So you can see that Hollywood had to come up with something, and trying new stuff is what they always do. And if there's a counterculture out there, Hollywood tries to co-opt it, corrupt it, and fold it into the pie. And during the time these people were doing their new kinds of movies, Hollywood was also making movies like The Man Who Would Be King, The Sting, Rocky, Patton, The Sunshine Boys, which is like my idea of, you know, nothing, Murder on the Orient Express, Save the Tiger, The Way We Were, a major hit in 1973, allegedly sort of about counterculture, but really kind of a love story. And Love Story itself came out in 1970. So Hollywood is always trying to beat the odds by taking out insurance. So they turned to the new people to see what they could do. They did not exactly welcome them with open arms. And most of those people, especially like Marty Scorsese, will tell you that it was tough going for them in the beginning.
It was tough, but they were there with a new kind of film that really, as you say, Janine, diversified what Hollywood offered, grabbing onto the counterculture. They certainly didn't co-opt and corrupt it right out of the box. Gary, in 1971, The French Connection, a new level of kind of gritty presentation here.
Yeah, 1971, French Connection, William Friedkin directs. He's an ex-documentarian. He brings that documentary style to this wonderful, gritty story about Eddie Egan, a New York Police Department cop. And they also bring in, we're introduced to Gene Hackman, who is my idea of the prototypical 70s actor. He's not good looking. He's kind of rough. And in French Connection, he goes in and rouses up a bar, and you can hear him. He is not Sam Spade. He is not Sergeant Friday. He's a different kind of cop.
What's my name?
Doyle.
What?
Mr. Doyle.
Come here. You pick your feet. Get over that. Get your hands on your head. We told you people were coming back. We're going to keep coming back here until you clean this bar up. Keep your eye on your neighbor. He dropped something that belongs to you. Turn around there, fella. What do we got here, huh? This belong to you? Huh? Pay attention, we're gonna ask questions later. You and you. Move the ass when I call you!
Get in.
You! Get it on the bar!
What the hell in there?
Put your hand on your head. Smart ass, you drop something, pick it up. You want that hand broken? Get it up there. You're under arrest. That goes for you too. Get that phone. Come on.
Move!
Move!
Keep
talking. Sit in there.
Gene Hackman in The French Connection, 1971. And here, Janine Basinger, counterculture in the guise of a cop.
Well, you know, I've seen that scene before in On Dangerous Ground, Nick Ray's film of the 1950s, when Robert Ryan does the same thing, lines them up against a bar, toughs them up, and then later goes in and beats the heck out of a female so that she will tell him what he wants to know, pulling on his black gloves and saying to her, "Why do you make me do it?"
So interchangeable parts from 70s and 50s,
you know,
or something else?
Well, it has to do, I think, with... It's not that we didn't see corrupt cops, violent cops, or any of that before, but it's that what happens is it's more of style rather than content. Mm-hmm. Here you go right into a realistic setting. You've got, as Darren nicely pointed out, not a good-looking guy, you know, not a movie star-looking kind of guy being the anti-hero. You can go down the streets in a chase out where real people, it looks like you're running over real people in the streets. I mean, it's partly a matter of visual style more than content, because we had these ugly, ugly people in movies from the beginning. I mean, who were Bogart and Cagney and Robinson in some of their pictures? So what these young new filmmakers brought was an incredible new style of energetic, on the set, violent, you know, freewheeling kind of filmmaking that they had learned in school. And they had seen all the great violent films of the past, and they amalgamated what they had learned in content, updated it, and shoved it in the faces of the viewer in a new-looking way.
In this loose, dirty, kind of low-down way, it wasn't all set under screaming subways. And, of course, the war in Vietnam was the backdrop to so much of the film that we remember from the 70s. 1970, Robert Altman came out with MASH. And, of course, the setting, Garen, was supposed to be Korea. But the attitudes that were running through this film were all about growing out of Vietnam.
Oh, yeah. Everyone who was on that set, everyone involved with that film, knew that they were making a Vietnam film. They weren't making a Korea film. And it's interesting to note that Fox, which produced this film, was also making Tora, 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 and Patton at the same time. So they were kind of sort of off to the side and doing their own little thing. As long as they came under budget, no one was really knowing that they were being very subversive, very anti-authoritarian, very anti-war. And Robert Altman, who was more interested in characters rather than stories, created probably the quintessential anti-war film of the period. Elliot Gould and Donald Sutherland are the stars, Trapper John and Hawkeye. They end up going to Japan at one point to operate on the congressman's son, and they act up and get into all sorts of trouble with the local colonel.
I'll have you court-martialed.
Oh, come off it, Colonel. You won't have us. We have you. Your boys blew this case, and we bailed you out. Now, we are going to stay here for one more day and check out the congressman's kid and get in some golf for ourselves. If that's okay with you, then we got a deal.
And if it isn't, then we can always call Washington and you tell them your story and we'll tell them ours. It's simple as that.
In the meantime, we are going to be at the pro shop where we are going to have a shower and a shave. If you want to get in touch with us, that is where we will be.
There it is, MASH from 1970. Jack Beatty, This is the kind of irreverent anti-war film at the beginning of the 70s. We'll look after a break coming up here at how things turned at the end of the 70s. I remember, I mean, our image of MASH now is from the TV show that got all warm and cuddly over the years, but I remember just falling out of my seat in that darkened theater in laughter at the irreverence of MASH. It was a kind of, to me as a very young kid in 1970, a shocking level of irreverence.
Yes, it was sort of like irony bears it away. I mean, in a way, it was these doctors, professionals, being superior to war. It was the sitcom approach to war, the gag-a-moment approach. And as the movie went on, you realized, hey, these guys whooping it up and using the war for an occasion for one-liners are sort of figures for the rest of us who stayed at home in the 1960s and who didn't fight and who, you know, went on about our lives and we were sort of superior to war, too. There was also a cruel streak in this film. Pauline Kael, in her review, I remember it still, talking about how cruel the movie was to Sally Kellerman, who played the nurse. worse. She is humiliated physically again and again in this film, and a real streak of mean in the movie. But yeah, there is that feeling of, hey, war, we don't have to take it seriously.
Irreverent. We're looking at movies of the 70s tonight. We've got to take a short break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. On Point. We're talking tonight about movies from the 1970s, the decade that Hollywood got real, got crazy, got gritty. My guest tonight in the studio with me, Garen Daly, On Point's movie maven. Joining us tonight from Madison, Wisconsin, Janine Basinger, chair of film studies at Wesleyan University and author of A Woman's View, How Hollywood Spoke to Women, 1930 to 1960. And in Hanover, New Hampshire, our own On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty. War and the backdrop of war ran through so much of what we remember about film in the 1970s. We heard the laugh track, Jack, as you said, the sitcom irreverent view of war in MASH at the beginning of that decade. By the end of the decade, it was kind of Wagnerian and dark and Deer Hunter. Garen Daly, this really got into a Baroque darkness around war.
Yeah, you have to remember the film starts off in Pennsylvania in a kind of depressed economic section, but the people are still holding together. They are very clannish. They end up living and dying and, you know, getting married, and a bunch of them go over to Vietnam, and the film is really about the damage done to the people there by the war. And at the end, they've just buried their good friend Nick, played by Christopher Walken, and they are feeling patriotic, they're feeling sad, they're feeling ironic, and spontaneously they begin to sing.
God bless America, land that I love, stand beside her and guide her through the night with the light from above. From the mountains to the prairies to the ocean white with foam, God bless America, my home, sweet home. God bless America, my home, sweet home.
It's the Nick.
It's the Nick.
Meryl Streep, Robert De Niro, John Savage, and Michael Cimino's 1978 Deer Hunter. Janine Basinger, Hollywood has made war movies forever. How would you describe what happened to that genre in the 70s, the Vietnam decade?
Well, first of all, the first thing that happened was, as has been said here, is they displaced the war into something else. Because it was an unpopular war or controversial war, nobody started making Vietnam movies right away, except for a few B films, and they did it in Korea, or they did it on the home front, or they did it in the Western and put violence and the exploitation of America crossing borders into Mexico.
Because it was too hot to handle it head on.
Yeah, it was not what it. Well, and also remember, the audience was looking at it every night on the TV set. You know, if you're getting it for free at home, you don't need to pay out, go and see it. And also, they couldn't be sure what stand to take to get the mass dollars out of the viewer. So finally, toward the end of the decade, you know, or as they move along, they try to start addressing it. There were some traditional combat films. I did write a book on the combat film. There was, you know, The Boys in Company C. There was Go Tell the Spartans. But they mostly avoided this and then slowly started to bring it back. And as Darren, you know, importantly pointed out, Deer Hunter doesn't start in combat. It starts in a world of Americans living in their place and then takes them out into this new thing that's going to destroy everything for them. And that slowly the issue of Vietnam came on the movie screen in a new way. and it was a different kind of combat. But it was not addressed directly during the conflict itself, or at least during the early years. And most people in the business that I talked to interview felt that because every night the combat film was on your evening news with the handheld light cameras that could go right in and follow everyone around, that this wouldn't be something people wanted to pay for, the cynical Hollywood view.
Yeah. Jack Beatty, I mean, nobody who lived it really wants to relive the dark romance, for all that dark romance of the 1970s. And yet with these war films, and at a couple of other points, we feel this decade maybe touched this one. You know, knock wood, we don't really want it to, but what's going on in Iraq is starting, for anyone who lived in that decade or who pays attention to these films, you can't help but hear the ghost in the attic. And yet Hollywood's cut differently these days.
Yes, you certainly can. Certainly in the historical events, right in The Deer Hunter, where, you know, these guys are victims, you could say. They're the cannon fodder of the war. They live there in that steel town. No college for them. You know, not for them what Dick Cheney with his five deferments said, I had other priorities, when he was asked about Vietnam. They didn't have other priorities. And at the same time, the movie sort of turned the war around, and we saw, wait a minute, yeah, they are victims, but by God, look how satanic the enemy is. Torture. Russian roulette. And, of course, people at the time said, well, there's no example of that. But we know now from John McCain, from others, that torture was practiced pretty regularly at the Hanoi Hilton and other places.
On POW.
Yeah, and so you get these guys who are victims, who should be bitter, who should be angry, yet they end with God bless America. And I think what you see there is some of the feeling that's even alive today, that somehow the belief in the country can survive all these horrors. And that if we only have this simple reconciling piety, all the contradictions will go away and we will all God bless America.
Janine, I want to put it to you. We don't know what kind of pressure cooker we may yet get fully into it in this decade, but it started out with trauma, sure enough, with 9/11, and now it's got a war that's feeling weird and wobbly, and you know, it can't end soon enough for most people, and yet no one can tell how it's going to end. Do you see the seams in Hollywood today open to different kinds of interpretation, open to political ferment, or not? Is that just going to be off screen this time?
Hollywood is open to anything that they think will make money. This is the bottom line of Hollywood. They will be making September 11 movies. They already are making September 11 movies. They will be making combat movies in Iraq, but first they have to figure out what the story is and what the public wants to see about the story and how they want, they've got to find a way to sell it. That's very cynical, but it's true. I mean, they're in the business of entertainment, not history, and entertainment, not political analysis. And so they'll try to find out what is the story. And there's openness in Hollywood more than you think to making money, and just as they folded in Marty and all of these guys, they'll do that again if they can find the way. But films take a couple of years to be written and produced and edited and marketed today. So they've got a margin of time here. Any film that's getting, you know, put together now, it's going to be a couple of years before it hits us. So they're going to lay back and see what's happening. But they will be open. We have a wider range now of filmmaking opportunities for young people and for eclecticism to hit us. I mean, we're making a lot of different movies now. Then we have new voices, new stories, new groups, new ethnic groups, new sexual groups are being put on the screen in wider numbers and playing your neighborhood theater more.
Do you feel newness on a par with the kind of new wave that we saw in the 70s?
No, I don't. I don't. I'm hoping I will suddenly see it coming from somewhere. But the 70s gave us more sex and violence, more paranoia and conspiracy, more disaster movies, more martial arts and exploitation movies, more sequels, and put Vietnam out there for us. It's a perfect thing for this decade to go back to. It's very hard. You know, we look back in the 70s. Now we can see what was good. I remember well at the time of the 70s, everybody sat around, you know, on things like this saying, it's the end of Hollywood. These movies are no good. No one is going to go to them. Sure, a handful of liberals will go, but nobody else will go. Now we have it in perspective. What they brought to us was really the saving of Hollywood and the opening up of it and taking it somewhere else.
Because it reconnected Hollywood with society in a more genuine way? Is that what you're saying?
It reconnected Hollywood with some of society, but it reconnected Hollywood partly with its old roots. It went back to the genres that had been created, and it was interesting that Jack mentioned the 1930s, another time of economic disaster that put some pretty tough pictures of America up on the screen. And, you know, they energized those old genres. They made them more realistic. They made them harder, tougher, and they put them out in the streets, in the real streets of America. And that was an important thing.
Well, and there we can draw a straight line. Speaking of tough America, speaking of putting it in the streets and hearkening back to those old themes, 1972, Godfather, unforgettable. It was my first date with a woman who remains my wife. I can't forget it that way
See,
either.
She married you because of that.
Yeah, what was it? You know, the horse's head? I hope
film.
Not.
You marry a guy who takes you to a good movie on the first date. I can tell you, we women have that. Guys, write this down. That's what we do.
Baby, it worked for me, Janine. Garrett, take us back to that big one.
Well, you know, The Godfather, again, 1972, Francis Ford Coppola is directing. You know, this is a very classically structured drama. Just think Marlon Brando as the Godfather as a king, and that he's got three sons to inherit his kingdom. And what's nice about this when we're talking about 70s films is, again, the Godfather and his family is outside the norm. They are not the regular American. They are creating their own institution, the institution being the mafia. And at some point in the film, Marlon Brando, who's just been shot, is speaking with his son, Al Pacino, Michael Corleone, and he is literally passing the torch. He's giving him the mantle of his kingdom back over to his son.
I never wanted this for you. I worked my whole life. I don't apologize to take care of my family. And I refused to be a fool, dancing on the string held by all those big shots. I don't apologize, that's my life, but I thought that when it was your time, that you would be the one to hold the strings. Senator Corleone, Governor Corleone, something.
I'm not a peasant of Anta.
Well, this wasn't enough time, Michael. Wasn't enough time.
We'll get there, Pop. We'll get there.
Not treacle here, but the message, this is America, too. This is the undercurrent in America. Jack Beatty, you remember Godfather and how it hit you? What was the message that you took away from that one?
Well, it's a study of corruption, isn't it? Of the corruption of this young man, Michael, who really sacrifices his marriage, his integrity, even his brother to his ambition, to the necessity to keep the family going. And some people at the time thought it was really about business, that it was about business in America and about the sacrifice of integrity and often family that goes on in business. And others saw it as what it was, a sort of saga of immigrant life. And not very influential, but something I must say I felt was that it was very difficult. It was a burden for Italian Americans to have to bear up under this film. And the Italian-American Defamation Societies and others rightly protested the glamorization of their this very small part of their lives. And it's been a kind of, it seems to me, a kind of incubus for them ever since.
But it did make it kind of grand in a very dark way. I want to put it right back-to-back with Chinatown. Garen Daly, bring this in so we can look at them side by side.
Well, what you want to look at here is institutions. I mean, you're talking, even with the Godfather logo, you saw strings there, and you heard Marlon Brando talking about holding the strings. Mm-hmm. It's all about institutions controlling life and people behind the scenes.
So there's Francis Ford Coppola. 2 years later, Roman Polanski, 1974, Chinatown.
Creates a detective story with Jack Nicholson and Faye Dunaway. But it's not about diamonds and thieves and gangsters. It's about power and water in Los Angeles. So the institution of controlling what's going on in the growth of Los Angeles is all wrapped up in Chinatown.
And that's what you were going to do in the Valley.
That's what I am doing. The bond issue passes Tuesday. There'll be $8 million to build an aqueduct and reservoir. I'm doing it.
Going to be a lot of irate citizens when they find out that they're paying for water that they're not going to get.
Oh, that's all taken care of. See, Mr. Gitz, either you bring the water to L.A. or you bring L.A. to the water.
How are you going to do that?
By incorporating the Valley into the city. Simple as that.
How much are you worth?
I have no idea. How much do you want?
No, I just want to know what you're worth. Over $10 million?
Oh, my, yes.
Why are you doing it? How much better can you eat? What can you buy that you can't already afford?
The future, Mr. Gitz. The future.
The future in Chinatown, back to back there with The Godfather. Jeanine Basinger, you've said, yeah, Hollywood goes where the money is. In both of these, we have money, we have corruption. We have that kind of spotlight, also the bringing back of older formats here. But I wonder, I know we've only got you for a couple minutes more. Speak about the political throw weight of this kind of Hollywood film in the 1970s. Compare it to the political throw weight today. Does Hollywood still have the capacity, the nerve, after the, you know, the embalming of the Dixie Chicks, whatever the bucks may be, to try and get out there and throw a political message for profit?
Well, you know, once Hollywood found out that actors could become the president and the governor and all that, I think they started shifting around a little bit about what they might want to do. I'll tell you that Hollywood, I think, I don't know the answer to that question, and I don't think anyone does. But I do know that, you know, people tend to forget that in Hollywood you have people living who have families and they're citizens and they vote and they have political statements, and somewhere out there there will be some brave little people. The issue is always, what does the public want? Because during the time we were looking at The Godfather and Chinatown, we were undergoing a kind of self-loathing as a nation and trying to figure out what the heck happened. Here are two familiar genres, the American immigrant family story and the detective story, that have been recouched for us with a kind of strip off the veneer of glamour and myth and take a look at Sam Spade and Philip Marlowe for what they really might have been. They went down the mean streets and they got mean. Or take a look at what it really meant for an immigrant family to suddenly become rich and powerful. Think what they had to do to get there. It made us reconsider ourselves, reconsider our institutions. All of that was, and people wanted that. So if people want to see that kind of questioning of the Iraq war and of what's going on now, and let's hope they do, you know, I'm sure we're going to see movies about it. I don't think we can assume we won't, but I don't have my hopes up either.
Well, more movies to come. Looking back at the 70s, Jeanine Basinger, I know we have to let you go, but thank you so much for being with us tonight. It's been great.
Thanks. It was my pleasure. And goodbye to Darren and Jack, too.
Jeanine Basinger is chair of film studies at Wesleyan University. She joined us tonight from Madison, Wisconsin. We are looking tonight at the films of the 70s, a kind of breakout, breakdown, gritty, sometimes real, and sometimes fantastic decade in Hollywood. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for this
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the movies of the 70s. What a decade it was. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Apocalypse Now, Deer Hunter, Annie Hall, Chinatown, French Connection, Mean Streets, Nashville, Deliverance. You know, on and on. Five Easy Pieces started off Being There, Cabaret, Superman, kind of all over. But of course, here came the great scary blockbuster with Jaws. Jack Beatty, sooner or later, that kind of thrill movie would gobble up everything else.
Yeah, that's just what happened, Tom. I mean, Matthew Arnold said that literature is a criticism of life. And briefly, in the 1970s, movies were a criticism of life. You couldn't get away from it. They were about the way Americans live today. They were not happy endings. They were unsparing. They were dark. And always they were dramas. That is, the problems were inside the people. Now, of course, our problems are what? An animal, a shark. I mean, a fish. So, and that spectacle film, suddenly Hollywood discovered, wait a minute, we can make blockbusters as routine things. Let's get away from all this alienation and let's just do, say, Star Wars. And film historians date the end of the real sort of personal film to that shark surfacing.
So who knows if we'll hit if we try human drama, Ghirardelli, but if we go for the fin in the water, for the explosion in space, we've got a good chance of a spectacle that will sell.
And that's exactly what, as Jack was saying, it's exactly what Hollywood has morphed into. They've morphed into this, what I call, potato factory, and where they make nothing but these big, huge blockbuster films that are geared away from being personal, little insightful views of what life is about. And you have to wonder whether or not we're going to get back to that. I actually think we might.
Well, there was criticism straight out of the whole world of media in the middle of that 70s film cascade. Network made a big impression, Gary.
Network made a big impression on everybody, and I love this film. 1976, Faye Dunaway, William Holden, taking a really hard look with Padashevsky's script there about the world of media and how we are manipulating and how it works. And there's nothing better than, when we finally meet the real forces behind the TV. We think it's Faye Dunaway, we think it's William Holden, but there's actually somebody else.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale.
It has been since man crawled out of the slime. And our children will live, Mr. Beale, to see that perfect world in which there's no war or famine, oppression or brutality. One vast and ecumenical holding company for whom all men will work to serve a common profit, in which all men will hold a share of stock, all necessities provided, all anxieties tranquilized, all boredom amused. And I have chosen you, Mr. Beale, to preach this evangel.
Why me?
Because you're on television, dummy.
Ned Beatty there playing the television station head in Network. Jack Beatty, it's hard to imagine that speech, long speech in a film today, and we certainly haven't seen that vast and ecumenical holding company taking care of all necessities around this globe. But boy, they were dukes up there.
They sure were. And you talk about a statement to the future. I mean, in those days, the networks were independent standing companies. Now they're part of mega corporations. So that prophecy has come into its own. You know, the irony of this film that goes back to something Janine said is that Howard Beale goes nuts on the air. Mm-hmm. And the network thinks, oh, my God, this is crazy. And suddenly the audience says, we want this. And instead of, suddenly there's a buck to be made in alienation.
Right,
and so they build a little, okay, we'll do alienation. And it just shows the sort of co-opting quality of the media. You can't get outside it because it'll go outside with you and say, hey, let's have a business here.
70s, Garen, ended with the little man still stepping up and strutting in Saturday Night Fever, the sense that, hey, it's gritty down here, but we're going to make the most of it. We're putting on our plumage.
Yeah. You know, Is there any better scene than seeing John Travolta walking down the street with that paint can with the sounds of the Bee Gees in the background? He is cocky. He is full of himself. And the little man, despite everything, is, you know, trying to find his little niche there. And with John Travolta, he finds it is dancing. But there's a price to pay. I mean, first he had to look the part. He had to have the right clothes on. And he also had to have the right hair.
One pork chop! One!
Hey, Frank!
It's disgusting, right? Sick. We just washed the hair.
Yeah.
You know, I work on my hair a long time, and you hit it. He hits my hair.
Pork chop spaghetti and out of work and Saturday Night Fever. Garandele, are these the films from the 70s with all the grit, with the ultimate, the kind of cocky strut there going off into the sunset and the spectacles that you know followed? Are these the films that you reach back for? Are these on your classic film shelf?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, I love them. I mean, there's other great films. There's like Rocky, a perfect example of a young boy who follows his dream. And, of course, the fact that Sylvester Stallone wrote it and made it his entree into being a megastar. And I think that when you look at Rocky, you also see what happened to these films because they ended up getting a little too much steroids and getting a little too blown up out of their own self-importance. We lost it. And part of that comes back to the fact that the money was elsewhere or, you know, being made. When you look at Saturday Night Fever, you have to remember more money was made on the music, on the album, than the actual film itself. And Hollywood took notice of that and became very interested in ancillary markets and tying in all the cultural pieces to make a lot of money. So the personal film got hurt. I still go back and watch them because they were so good.
Well, for a moment, telling it like it was in the 1970s, via Hollywood. Garandele, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
And Jack, thanks for being along.
Thank you, Tom.
Keep that disco beat going up there, Jack.
Thank you.
You can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
Taha Yassin Ramadan has been captured in Mosul, according to the Department of Defense. He was Saddam's vice president and is number 20 on the U.S. most wanted list.
CENTCOM announced the capture of Chemical Ali, number 5 on the most wanted list. Each day, more Iraqis are coming forward with information, and with their help, the coalition has now captured or killed 42 of the 55 most wanted.
The Republicans behind this recall say they want you to oust me for past mistakes. My friends, they don't give a rip about past mistakes. This is all about control in the future, seizing back the governor's chair, and believing with so many candidates running for office, they can do it with just a handful of California voters.
We're going to have a presence at the court 24 hours a day, and should they try to remove the Ten Commandment monument, we will peacefully intervene, kneel around the monument, kneel around any forklift that they would try to take the monument out of the court.
This case is not about a monument. It's not about politics or religion. It's about the acknowledgement of God.
I know the Palestinian Authority is going to condemn it, as they usually do. You know, their talk is cheap. They've not taken one measure to try to prevent these kind of things from happening. And therefore, the empty words that they share are going to do nothing when you have the blood of children shed tonight.
Without the presence of American monitors on the ground in order to guarantee the implementation of the roadmap, things are liable to more deterioration.
The alternative is what? Just more death and destruction? Let the terrorists win? Let those who have no interest in a Palestinian state win? Let those who have no interest but killing innocent people win? No, that is not an acceptable outcome.
fighting.
Part of the building is entirely destroyed. It was a car bomb that was right under Mr. Viera Di Mello's office. This is really an outrage against people who have come from all parts of the world to help Iraq.
The death of any colleague is hard to bear, but I can think of no one we could less afford to spare or who would be more acutely missed throughout the UN system than Sergio.
I do not know who they are, and I don't know what their cause is and which God they pray to, but what they did will not serve their cause nor their God.
By their tactics and their targets, these murderers reveal themselves once more as enemies of the civilized world.
There in arresting bloody week, Saddam's vice president, also known as Saddam's Knuckles, is captured in Mosul. Donald Rumsfeld also announces the capture of Chemical Ali Hassan al-Majid, number 5 on the most wanted list. Embattled California Governor Gray Davis lashes out against the Republican-led recall effort. Reverend Patrick Mahoney and Alabama Chief Justice Roy Moore remain defiant against a federal order to remove a Ten Commandments monument from the Alabama Judicial meeting, a building. At least 21 pro-monument demonstrators have been arrested so far. A suicide bomber explodes a crowded bus in an ultra-Orthodox neighborhood in Jerusalem, killing 20 and injuring more than 100. Daniel Seaman, spokesman for Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, there blames the Palestinian Authority. Israel retaliates with the assassination of Hamas leader Ismail Abu Shanab. Tens of thousands of Palestinians rallied at his funeral in Gaza. Palestinian Authority cabinet member Yasser Abed Rabo imploring there the United States for assistance. Secretary of State Colin Powell says the destruction of the Mideast peace process is not an option, and a massive truck bomb destroys the United Nations headquarters in Baghdad, injuring over 100 and killing 23, including the UN's top Iraq envoy, Sergio Vera de Mello. Jack Beattie, an awful lot of blood on the ground this week.
A terrible week all around. In Afghanistan, 90 people were killed this week, including a U.S. serviceman today in a Taliban offensive. But in Iraq, the strike at the U.N. Headquarters, this was right out of Clausewitz. Clausewitz says the aim of war is not to kill enemy soldiers, it's to break the national will of the enemy. And this was aimed right at our national will. Already, we heard on our program that congressmen are here getting an earful from their constituents now about this occupation. And we even heard from one source who said that even conservative Republican congressmen are talking about bringing the boys home by next year,
but that
getting
is
them
not,
out of there.
But that is not the language of the president. And we heard it there again. Our will not be broken.
Yes, I know. But when you get congressmen, even conservative Republicans, saying this sort of thing, it's telling. And, we have now lost 132 U.S. servicemen in this occupation. If 6 more precious lives are lost, then the number killed in this war after the war, as Anthony Cordesman calls it, will exceed the number killed in the war.
They aren't good numbers, not a pretty picture, and a lot of new, fresh thinking, we hope, going on in Washington and around the world about what to do, but more or less a stalemate at the U.N. at this point.
It is, and a stalemate in Washington between state and defense. I mean, Donald Rumsfeld does not want the U.N. there. He basically thinks this is strictly a military problem, the U.N. is in the way, and we don't want any more people there. So,
Jack, what else caught your eye this week?
Well, today's leak, the front page of the New York Times, 17,000 power plants are going to be exempted from a provision of the Clean Air Act, meaning they'll be able to pollute the air more. I have one question about that. Does anybody think that this would happen if we had a system of publicly financed elections? The answer is no.
That's a pretty simple answer from the Jack Beattie perspective, N-O.
It sure is.
Well, but that's the way things are going. Jack, it looks like we're just about out of time here, but have a great weekend. Thanks for being with us.
And you too.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Support for this